In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The statement of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, which was issued by the leader on the 40th anniversary of the victory of the revolution, was indeed the upper hand document of establishing the new Islamic civilization. Among the oppressed nations, few stage a revolution, and among those which do so, few have managed to finish the job. In other words, among those few nations which have changed the ruling system, very few have successfully kept the ideals of revolution in the face of hostilities and plots. But the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian nation was an exception in this regard. It has been the most popular revolution of not the 20th century, but several centuries. Therefore, it has boastfully insisted on its ideals, despite 43 years of ceaseless hostility and conspiracy of enemies. The Islamic Revolution terminated the long history of decadence. Iran had been humiliated during various kingdoms, particularly the Qajarid and Pahlavi rules. Ayatollah Khamenei says on the backwardness of Iran during the Pahlavi regime, "Before the rule of Islam in this country, we were a backward nation in the full sense of it. We were dependent, politically backward, scientifically backward, socially backward, and isolated in the world of politics. Today, the progresses of the Islamic Republic have urged even our enemies to admit. Today, in the scientific ranking, in the technological ranking, in many modern sciences of the world, we are at the grade of advanced countries. The Islamic Ummah, with a strenuous and serious effort, can design the Islamic civilization of this era to set its foundations, to make it flourish and put it forward before the eyes of mankind." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, introducing the Islamic civilization, says, "In the new Islamic civilization, spirituality stands beside material issues and ethics. Spirituality is beside the progress of material life." Ayatollah Khamenei further explains that the new Islamic civilization consists of two parts, namely, instrumental and real. The instrumental part includes the values that we consider as progress, such as sciences, inventions, industry, politics, economy, political and military might, international position, etc. The real part of the civilization consists of lifestyle and whatever shapes our life, like family, way of marriage, kind of house, type of clothing, consumption pattern, kinds of food, cuisine, entertainment, job and employment, way of conduct at work, behavior in university, school and the media, behavior with friends, enemies and foreigners. According to the Quran, material and spiritual growth will come to existence once the society and individuals move in the way of God. In view of this, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, introduced monotheism as the core of his mission. The knowing of prophethood, which comes after monotheism, also means knowing the Islamic unity and civilization. The Prophet founded the Islamic unity and civilization and fulfilled many social, cultural, political, and economic changes to set the ground for establishment of a glorious global civilization in a short period. Thus, the monotheistic Oman Islamic civilization thereof are based on the rule of Allah. Ayatollah Khamenei, stressing this issue, maintains that the society based on monotheism will achieve all beliefs which the Islamic civilization brings about. According to verse 257 of chapter Baqarah of the Quran, Allah is the guardian of the faithful. He brings them out of darkness into light. Thus, the reality of the Islamic civilization is to get distant from darkness and entering light. Ayatollah Khamenei says, the world of Islam today is duty-bound to breathe the spirit in this world, like Islam itself and the Prophet himself, to create a new atmosphere, to open a new way. We call this phenomenon, which we are waiting for, as the new Islamic civilization. We should pursue the new Islamic civilization for mankind. This basically differs from what the powers are thinking and doing for mankind. It does not mean capturing lands. It does not mean transgressing upon the rights of nations. It does not mean imposing one's ethics and culture on other nations. It means to present the divine gift to nations so that nations, through their free will, through their choice, and through their distinguishing, choose the right way. The way towards which today the world powers have taken nations is a wrong and a straight way. This is our duty today. Dear friends, the victory of the Islamic Revolution and emergence of the Islamic Iran as a powerful country, challenging the very existence of big powers, has made it possible to found a new Islamic civilization. Ayatollah Khamenei says, unity is not a political and tactical move. It is rather a heartfelt belief and faith in the necessity of the unity of the Islamic Ummah. The first step in the unity of the Islamic Ummah is for the Muslim communities, governments, ethnicities, and denominations to refrain from aggressing on and striking one another to get united against the common enemy. And in the next steps, the Islamic countries should have synergy and make effort together in sciences, riches, security, and political power in order to reach the new Islamic civilization. The Islamic Revolution is marking its 43rd anniversary. Although the enemies of this revolution have incessantly skimmed innumerable plots since the birth of this revolution to destroy it, it has stood tall in the world and kept inspiring new generations to withstand big powers with the hope in a bright future in which there would be no place for the global arrogance symbolized in the US and the fabricated Zionist regime of Israel.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haidar. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having us.
So, really interesting question today, and it's about the Islamic Republic of Iran. Is it a model? Can it be a model? I mean, it's rising out of the flames of the hegemony of the Western powers and the Eastern powers as well. It's becoming this independent, free state. So the question is this: can it become a model for other Muslim countries and perhaps even the world? And I'm going to go to Sayyid Mahdi first.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thanks again for having us on the program. Before I answer that question, there was one thing that I wanted to bring up. In a previous program, we had talked about atomic weapons, you know, and this idea that the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that the production and keeping and using these nuclear weapons is haram, it is prohibited in Islam, and it is an un-Islamic thing. You know, before the world and this Western propaganda points a finger at the Islamic Republic for, you know, maybe in the future you might potentially have, you know, nuclear weapons. And I'm saying that because it's a might, potential, perhaps, maybe, you know, we don't want you to get close enough by this many yards. Okay, first of all, who's, like we had said, who are the countries who actually have nuclear weapons, right? So when you just look at the United States and Russia, these are two countries who have nuclear weapons in the thousands. In the thousands, huh? Not one. We all saw the damage that one nuclear weapon can have on an entire city of hundreds of thousands. And so here, the United States and Russia have each in the thousands of nuclear weapons. So they could destroy the whole world over if, you know, somebody crazy enough came into the government and had control over these things. And it's not just United States and Russia who has nuclear weapons. You see, Britain, France, China, India, Pakistan, these are all nuclear weapons countries. They have nuclear weapons. Most probably Israel and perhaps North Korea. These are countries that have nuclear weapons. And what's even more interesting is from all of these countries that have, so Russia has thousands of nuclear weapons, okay. But then when you actually ask the question on who used nuclear weapons, the only answer is the United States of America.
Yeah.
Who used nuclear weapons. It is the only country in the history of humanity that has used nuclear weapons, right? And not just once, but twice. Okay, so let's say that you say the first time they used it, it was a mistake, and they apologized, oh crap, you know, this is a really serious weapon, it can destroy hundreds and thousands of innocent civilians. No, after they dropped the first one, they dropped the second one. So even if the first one, for argument's sake, was a mistake, the second one was most definitely on purpose. And it was after witnessing the effects of the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So really, United States is where the whole world should be pointing their finger to. And be like, hey, why do you guys have nuclear weapons? You actually use them on people. You're the real threat to the world and security of the world. Not a country like the Islamic Republic who doesn't have weapons physically, you know. They don't, religiously, they don't want to, they can't, they will not. They have chosen voluntarily, because of the religion, to not create or manufacture nuclear weapons. This is not a country that should be being taken out on the limelight. Just one quick thing, because this is really important. There's a lot of negative propaganda against the Islamic Republic, and that's why I wanted to bring it up, right? Naturally, if you have the United States, and you have Russia, and you have Britain, and you have France, and you have China, and you have India, and you have Pakistan, most probably you have Israel, all of these guys have nuclear weapons. Is it not rational for other people to also want nuclear weapons to defend themselves? No, we'll get to not having it all. If the United States and all of these countries have nuclear weapons in the thousands, right? Why should other countries who are really defenseless in front of a vast, you know, ammunition, a vast array of nuclear weapons, they should have nuclear weapons too to defend themselves. This is the rational thing to do, right? And here you find the opposite. No, no, we're going to have thousands of nuclear weapons. You can't have any.
Yeah.
Man, what kind of world are you guys living in?
Yeah, and it's the opposite. The Americans say, you know, we want Iran to behave like a normal country. What do you mean? Like, you a normal country? America is not a normal country.
And so if yourself, and you know? here's mm. even the beauty of adding to what you said, right? That if you want Iran to behave like a normal country, and a normal country is the United States of America, well, okay, so then we should behave like a normal country and have nuclear weapons and drop nuclear weapons on other countries. You know, they don't know what to talk about. They don't know what their stance is. They have a weak foundation, and this is what causes trouble for them all across the world.
But Iran is not a normal country. Let's look at the realities. It is it's far from being a normal country. And actually, what Iran is essentially practically doing is providing a model for other Muslim countries to follow, and inshallah, the world as well. This model of independence, of freedom, of resistance against the Taghut. Now, Sheikh Ali, is it actually a feasible model, or?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, basically what we want is a nuclear free world, right? Why? There's a rationale behind it. Not just the fatwas and the religious verdict, which is incumbent and mandatory on all Muslims, but in addition to that, we understand and realize that the detriments and the damages and the collateral damage of nuclear or atomic bombs, the world has seen it through the United States of America, you know, and we do understand it through research and scientific understanding of things, that there are going to be innocent people that will be killed, which Islam does not allow. So we have a very principled stance, and that is to free and rid the world of nuclear weapon. America must not have it. Israel, it's not a country, right? So whatever. But even other countries who claim to possess or do possess or are in the process of making the nuclear weapons, our stance, our religious, our humanitarian, and our you know, even national stance when it comes to the Islamic Republic of Iran is very clear. It is a nuclear free world, not, as Sayyid pointed out, a discriminatory world where, you know, some countries have it and they bully other countries and the others don't have it.
Yeah, I just want to point out that that's about nuclear weapons, not nuclear energy. And I want to say this.
And we said it before too, that nuclear energy is the right of every country, every nation.
Yes, right? I want to say that statement, which is attributed to the leader, because it's a beautiful statement. It summarizes this whole thought. He says that nuclear weapons for none, nuclear energy for all.
Awesome. So this is what our stance is, right? Now, in terms of it being a model, see, first we have to analyze and understand what the model is, and once we understand what the model is, your question will be answered automatically.
Yes.
What the Islamic Republic of Iran, which used to be Iran only before the revolution, the Islamic Revolution, what did it bring to the table? What is different about it? So if you look at the nation, Iranian nation is the same Iranian nation that was in the time of Pahlavi and the Qajar regimes, right? It's the same Iranian nation. Now, you talk about Islamic scholars, they used to exist back in the day too. You talk about the Hoza, the Islamic seminary, it used to exist back in the day too. If you compare the shrines, the holy shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam and Hazrat Masuma alayhi salam, and also the Imam Zadeh, right, the progeny and the sons of Imams, they used to exist back in the day too. So what really changed, right? This is what we need to understand. This is where what it funnels down to. We need to understand that Iran, the new Iran, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, has brought dignity, human dignity, back to where it should be. The national dignity back to where it should be. The scientific and the academic and knowledge development and advancement and progress back to where it should be for any nation. So once you see these things in the context of how the world was laid out and was divided in two camps, that is the East and the West, the Soviets and the Americans, Iran disturbed that equation. Iran is like, no one should be superior to other nation. And that is one of the things that if you notice throughout the past couple of decades, actually over a decade for sure, that the negotiation, the talks about negotiations took place between Iran and the United States of America. One thing was clear, and that was from Iran's side, that we will sit on the table, negotiation table with you, if there are no preconditions. What gives you the right to put these preconditions before you can sit with us? You want to deal as a nation, consider us a nation, right? See how they brought back the human dignity and the national dignity back to the table? So now, if you ask anyone from any part of the world that how your nation should be treated by those who have more power in the world, they would say, we should be treated in a dignified way. So in one word, Iran brought back the dignity of not only Muslims, not only Shias, not only the followers of Ahlul Bayt, but the dignity of a human being.
Yes.
The dignity of a nation.
Yeah.
So now, if you ask anyone, they would say, yep, we want that dignity. We want that respect. We want to have that self-respect, right? We shouldn't be bullied around. We shouldn't be told what to do. We shouldn't be controlled. We shouldn't be strong-armed. All of these things. So now, if I were to ask you, does that become a model for the rest of the nations? Hell yeah.
It should.
Right? Yeah. It makes sense. Mm. It's logical, right?
Yeah.
Independence from the clutches of the world imperialism and oppression. Right? So this is something that Iran revived, and this is what other nations like Venezuela, they are getting inspired because of. Mm-hmm. Right? Nations like Iraq, who were subjugated and who were suppressed for the longest time ever, they also wanted to copy this model. They wanted to follow this model.
Yes.
Just one last point is that when we talk about model, there are discussions which of course are beyond the scope of this talk show or maybe this question.
Mm-hmm.
See, the Islamic Revolution, it brought back that centralization to the camp of the oppressed. This is how we need to look at it. It is not a revolution of a country. It is not a revolution of a people. Yes, Iranians are on the forefront, but it is a revolution of all the oppressed people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It is the revolution that brought Islam, the pure Muhammadan Islam, which is global in nature. It's not regional. It's not country-based. It revived that pure Muhammadan Islam and brought it to the forefront.
Yeah.
Right? And this has become the hope. Now, based on this, what I just said, the new model that the world needs to focus on and, of course, discuss and understand, absorb, and digest is that we have a Hukumat-e-Islami, an Islamic government, right, which is based on ideology. And what is that ideology? That ideology is pure Muhammadan Islam.
Yeah.
This becomes that center point, and the rest of the oppressed, the rest of the justice seekers, the rest of the humanity needs to take it as a focus to stand up for building a good and a healthy world around them.
Yeah.
Right? So basically, Iran becomes that center, the Islamic leadership leads from the front, and rest follow.
Yeah.
Right? They get their dignity through association. Right? And this is exactly what the system of wilaya is. If you can just imagine a pyramid. Mm. At the top of the pyramid are those just people, you know, people like Imam Khamenei, people like Imam Khomeini, who are the true ambassadors of pure Muhammadan Islam. They lead from the front. Lead who? The followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam?
Mm-hmm.
Not just that. They lead the entire camp of the oppressed, and they make and they team up against the oppressors of the world and give them a shut up call. This is the model that is evolving, and this is the new Islamic civilization that is in the works.
That's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed the show. From myself, from Sayyid Mehdi, from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please, don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
A museum to wonder and reflect. A prison for torture and control. And a spectacular palace fit for a king. Perhaps one might think that these three places don't have the faintest connection with each other. But it's amazing to see that the thread of time has woven them together to create the tapestry of the Qasr edifice. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. In this week's program, we take you to Tehran to explore a dreadful metamorphosis through time, the history of a palace that turned into a prison. But the story does not end there. The Qasr edifice has witnessed 200 years of Iran's history, the demise of the monarch era, and the birth of a revolution. Now, after decades since the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we bring you the untold stories of those who experienced the horrors of the edifice in its darkest years. Stay with us. Here's the first part.
Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October the 24th, 1978. Tehran, the glass prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the glass prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries, and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Qasr prison. Over the last two centuries, the building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Tehran, the Qasr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Qasr prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Qasr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fat Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
تهرانی که ما امروز با این گستره و عظمت شاهد اون هستیم.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Qasr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khorramabad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure. A large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin, the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fateh Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, "The palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion." In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasser al-Din Shah, the palace fell from grace and abandoned. A devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of 3 rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty.
در همین حد زندان در دوره قاجار وجود داشت. اما بعد از گویارویی که به
But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
در فکر تأسیس یک زندان بزرگ و گسترده باشند.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison.
Thank you.
Under Reza Shah, the gas prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers, and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. In the past, there were two underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the two canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom, to drink cool water, was coined, an idiom with a pleasant literal meaning but an unpleasant reference. Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalized the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in Savak, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
کل برنامه‌ها، مبادله اطلاعات، آموزش، تجهیزات با CIA بود.
Nipping any protest in the bud, SAVAK planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners and their inherent difference from criminals, in the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
بخش مستقل و ساختمان مستقلی به عنوان زندان سیاسی، بخش سیاسی زندان ساخته میشه.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Kahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband. Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد و موساد هم یه دفتری رو
It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK, and the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Dawood As-Saadi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As-Saadi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as Shah. But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle. Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
اهل مطالعه بودن، اهل علم بودن، اهل دانش بودن، بیشتر این جنبه رو قبول داشتن.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of SAVAK agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
از سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن، خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
مسیر را بیاد اگر یه زندانی هم آزاد شد دیگه از حواس زندان نکنه مثلا.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودن،
one afternoon it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating. They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
اللهم عظم بلائي وأفرط بي سوء حالي وقصرت بي أعمالي وقعدت بي أغلالي وحبسني عن نفعي بعد آمالي وخدعتني الدنيا بغرورنا ونفسي بجنايتها.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this part of the Kumail supplication, says, Allahumma adhuma bala'i, O Allah, my tribulation is tremendous. Wa afrata bi su'u hali, my bad state is excessive. Wa qasurat bi a'mali, my acts are inadequate. Wa qa'adat bi aghlali, and my fetters have tied me down. Regarding the first part about the word bala' or tribulation, we mentioned three different meanings from the insightful servants. About su'u hali, or the bad state that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions in this part, we also discussed about so many factors. And about the part wa qasurat bi a'mali, my acts are inadequate, in the previous episode we somehow concluded that even if we think that we have done all the obligatory deeds, even if we think that we have fulfilled our promises to the Almighty Allah, we have to be aware of our understanding, our desires, and in fact our true intentions. Did we have sincerity in all our intentions, in all our actions or not? If we have done some of our actions, some of our deeds with dullness, with jealousy, or with pride, the question is it really possible that these kinds of deeds, with stinginess or insincerity, can they really help us in reaching salvation? Can they help us to be freed from our misfortunes? This is what we have to consider in about our inadequacies of acts.
Oh Allah, my trials and sufferings have increased and my evilness has worsened. My good deeds have diminished and my misdeeds have become firm. And remote hopes restrain me from profiting with good deeds. And the world has deceived me with its allurements, and my own self has been affected by treachery and my delay. Therefore, my Lord, I ask you by your greatness not to let my sins and my misdeeds veil my supplications from you, and not to disgrace me by exposing those of which you have knowledge, nor to hasten my retribution for those vices and misdeeds committed by me in secret, which were due to evil-mindedness, ignorance, excessive lustfulness, and my negligence.
Thank you, Allah, God, that we hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Next, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَقَعَدَتْ بِأَغْلَالِي, my fetters have tied me down. In this part, Imam alayhi salam mentions the restrictive fetters or chains that have somehow blocked us from continuing our path. The insightful servants and the seekers of truth, explaining about the phrase, my fetters have tied me down, have stated that perhaps my fetters, or the bonds or chains, means the sins, and especially major sins, that restrict all human beings. And it is possible that the fetters are talking about these major sins that tie human beings down. The sins prevent the human beings from worshipping, from serving Allah, from having sincere servitude. These kinds of sins deprive all human beings from Almighty Allah's blessings. And evidence of this is an important tradition narrated from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. Someone told Imam Ali alayhi salam, "I used to perform the night prayers and the nafilas, but I can no longer do so." Imam alayhi salam said, in a very interesting sentence, "Anta rajulun qad qayyadatka dhunubuk." You are a person whose sins have become his fetters, tying him down, preventing him from night worshipping. So this is what exactly we mean by talking about restrictive fetters. From what do they stop us? How do they actually restrict us? In this tradition, one aspect was mentioned. أنت رجل قد قيدتك ذنوبك. This, such a person, can no longer perform night prayers and nafilas because of his own dhunub, because of his own sins. There is another possibility, that the fetters are useless entertainments and activities which prevent human beings from paying attention to the more important and real purposes of their lives. In tradition, from the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it is mentioned, "من حسن إسلام المرء تركه ما لا يعنيه." One of the good things a Muslim should observe is the abandoning of those activities that are of no use to him. This seems to be apparently the higher level of what was said in the first meaning. We shouldn't always think about the sins stopping us from reaching salvation, from doing recommended deeds. Sometimes even the deeds that are not really haram, or they're not called sins, can stop us from reaching salvation. تَرْكُهُ مَا لَا يَعْنِيهِ. The abandoning of the activities that are of no use to us means we have to prioritize our activities in our daily lives for reaching salvation and the station of closeness to the Almighty Allah's mercy. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Ya Allah, don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
IRIB English Radio.